podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
All right, the Reds, I'm Gareth Robertson. This is the Weekender from the Anfield Wrap. It's Halloween on Saturday, and what could be more scary than David Moyes, two fellas who made a fortune from selling dildos, and Karen Brady. Yes, that is right. West Ham are coming to town, but we've got loads coming up before we get to that. Our panel in the studio is Lizzie Doyle, Siobhan McGann and Mike Kearney. I'll be talking to them about this week in Liverpool FC life at the start and the Hammers at the end. But in between, we've got Paul Riley from Transition Liverpool with John Gibbons talking about a new project, Spark It Liverpool. And then we've got Neil Atkinson speaking to Dave O'Brien about his book on the culture industry in the UK that he has co-authored. OK then, Mike, a 2-0 win on Tuesday against Midtjylland, the Premier League champions' 20th competitive fixture behind closed doors and a 9th at a close-to-empty Anfield. It's fair to say, the reason I'm giving it that background, that context, I'm trying to do the lads a favour because it was fucking shit, wasn't it?
It was graft-like, wasn't it? It was graft till the goal, and the goal was sublime, and then it went graft again till the pen.
Yeah.
And the pen was like, yeah, Sam, we've won here. But honestly, like, much changed team, fresh legs, this, that, and the other. And, you know, we probably should have scored. Taki just misses across, don't he, early on. We started, just one of them. It must be getting to them a bit now. There's no crowd in there. I missed it on a whatever day it was. Tuesday, was it? Yeah, Tuesday.
It's
winter, like footy. You just miss being in the ground, don't you? So when we came back, it was March. Not March. June. Yeah, stopped in March. Come back in June. So it was weird. Like, but this is where we'd normally be going and like going to pub after it and stuff. June, July, you can sort of say, yeah, this is just a weird end of a weird season sort of thing, but...
I just think we almost treat it like it's another competition almost, because there's so many games and they're played in such different circumstances that we sort of can't consider it in the way we'd consider normal footy almost. But, Siobhan, it is 2 wins out of 2 in the Champions League. It's 4 unbeaten since we got absolutely bongoed in Birmingham by Aston Villa. So, you know, I'm taking the positives from that.
That's all you can do, isn't it? Like on Midtjylland, did anyone see the bananas way their lad put his shirt on? Did anyone see that clip going around?
Oh, hang on, yeah.
Where he puts it on his head and then he just like shuffles it down his body. I was just like, you don't deserve to be professional footballer after that.
I'm going to have a look at it. What should I type in?
I'm sure I saw it on like BT Sport or something on Twitter.
Yeah, it went viral.
Don't look at it now because it'll ruin your night. but yeah, it's all you can do is look at the positives, isn't it? I think that... what everyone knew was going to happen in this mad stage of the season was that people were going to drop like flies, and we've had more so than most, I think. And I think that makes it really hard to look at the positives because you just think, God, it's going to be really, really, like, it's hard work, isn't it, to watch these games without your best lads playing them, or at least playing it half of them, you know, every other game. And as much as these games, they're on top of you before you've even finished the last one. Like, especially these midweek games, they just surprise you so much, don't they, that they're so quick. But... yeah, I think that, like, it's when you're winning your games and you kind of Villa aside, all pretty expected results, really, apart from what could have been a Goodison. But, and that's not, you know, you can't be anything apart from positive about that. But it's just really hard to take when you know that every game that passes, something happens that makes the next game so much harder. And that's just going to keep happening. It's going to be quite cyclical, I think. Like, someone will come back. It's going to, like, one door opens, another door closes. And it's just going to be a bit. Hard work for the next few weeks, but it'll be fine.
As you say as well, I think that's going to be the case for everyone. There's just so much football, it's unbelievable. We'll come on to the sort of injuries and how Liverpool are going to cope with all that. But Lizzie, positives, staying on the theme of positives, Trent back to his top form. The Shaq was absolutely boss as well, just adding to his general vibe of just being a mad but boss fella. Another game under the belt for Alisson as well. Another goal for Jota. Mo on 7 goals. I mean, you know, it was graft to watch. I don't think we can dress that up. But, you know, now with the other side of it, we've won another game. And like I say, plenty of things there to get a smile on your face about.
Yeah, I can't really remember a lot about the game, to be honest. I'm thinking back
loads
to it.
Loads of it was dull.
Yeah, like there's, I think, so the positive there, another one obviously is a clean sheet as well, yep. which is really important. Another positive, and I'm just picking out more positives because it was, I'm trying to avoid talking about the actual match. Now, Reece Williams coming on, obviously we know that was because Fabinho went off, but Reece Williams coming on, putting a shift and looking decent. I mean, he was playing at Kidderminster, weren't he, last season? Mm. And that goes to show you what regular football can do, no matter what level. Like, you know, if he's sitting in the academy and not playing proper competitive league football, would he have been the next option? Do you know what I mean? So there was a lot to take. And I also liked, as much as it was graft, I liked that he didn't change the system with the sort of different players that he used. I thought he'd do 4-3-3 after us playing 4-2-3-1 at the weekend against Sheffield. I thought he'd revert to 4-3-3 and have that three that we saw at 30 minutes against Ajax, but he didn't. He stayed with his shape, and we obviously saw Origi coming in as the one, and I think that's interesting. I think like he's clearly trying to do something there, isn't he? It's another game under the belt. It's another practice in that sort of system, which they're not used to. You know, Jordan Henderson gets another game playing in as a two in midfield as well. So it was graft, but I think we just sort of move on now to the next game. And I think each game is going to be like that. I think it's different when Siobhan brings up there, like the Everton game of Goodison with so much to speak about and what could have been. But I think the games are going to come so quickly now that the most important thing is we've got 6 points out of six. We've won our easiest game at home. We've won arguably our hardest game away in the group. So we need to just, you know, crack on for the weekend, but also for Atalanta next week, which will be really tough.
Yeah, I think you're right to say that Reece Williams is another positive. And there's loads of stuff out there this week. I don't think we need to go into all of it, but you know, just about the idea that, you know, he was happy to go and play for Kidderminster rather than hanging around. He probably would have got a game for Liverpool sooner if he'd turned down that move, but he wanted to go and toughen up, and fair for complaint, and we'll come on to that. But Mike, a couple of negatives as well. I mean, apart from the just sort of the graft aspect of the game and that new shape as well being a little bit graft, I think you've got to say that Origi and Minamino are fairly unimpressive and haven't really taken their chances there in terms of impressing the manager.
No, there's a point in the game where you hear Henderson saying we need you to run in behind Saki, and he doesn't just say it, he rolls at him sort of thing. So there's obviously frustrations with the players in the pitch as well as us watching it sort of thing, and I feel sorry for Divock because, you know, Everton, he's been involved with at the club. You know, he'll go down in folklore, not just as a cult hero, by the way, but like, you know, genuine big goals, big games. And in a way, when Funes Mori does him in that derby,
it's 100%.
It was just watching him go off the pitch thinking, oh, I hope you come back, and he hasn't. You know, he's got the moments, hasn't he? He'd always have the Barca, he'd always have that Champions League moments. And he's such a young lad still. He's 25, I think, 26. He's young. So I thought, like, I thought he would have moved on after the Champions League. Definitely maybe this summer gone. It's just hard to watch him struggle because he does. Like, and we know the player he could have been.
It's hard without the regular football, though, as well, isn't it, for him to come in cold and shine.
It's sort of the team.
You were giving him a little bit of a benefit of the doubt.
You want to see Minamino play with Salah and Firmino more
exactly.
often?
Yeah.
You want to see, you know, maybe Origi would be a different player in them circumstances.
And in the position they want to play in as well, because, you know, with Taki, he's played for the first team, strongest team, if you like, but he was shunted out to a position that he didn't want to be in. So, I think you're right, Mike, in that. Probably for both of them, they're going to look better if they're playing with better lads, and they're going to look better if they're played in the position, and they're going to look better if they were played regularly, none of which is likely to happen, by the way.
I think, though, there's a bit of a different direction of travel for both of them, isn't there? Everyone's expecting more from Minamino and just gradually expecting less from Origi, and it's not unfair because we can only watch what's in front of us, but it's unfortunate.
Yeah, and I'll still advocate a statue for Divi. News on Fabinho's injury from that game is that he could be fit to return the other side of the November international break and maybe play Leicester at home. Brazil have ruled him out of those international matches. But in the meantime, Lizzie, West Ham on Saturday, which we're going to come into later on. Atalanta away, which you've mentioned, which is going to be really tough on Tuesday night. And then after that, Manchester City away on Sunday. So, you know, he's definitely not going to be there for those games. I mean, it was sort of slightly good news in that, you know, the injury isn't as bad as it looked and as bad as it could have been, but he's still out.
Yeah, it's a shame. Like, and it's a shame because of the context of what's going on with our centre-half, but I think in general, like, even if we would have had Van Dijk fit and Matip fit, Thiago fit, I think you'd still say it's a crying shame that he's out, because Fabinho is a fantastic footballer. And I think, I mean, I could be wrong, but I don't know if you'd all agree that everyone would want to see him against Man City at least. Yeah. Like, he's the player that... You know, he's one of the first on the team sheet for
You'd
that
want
game.
Him in midfield against Man City,
exactly.
As well.
Yeah. Exactly.
Just to make them fume about another goal that they're kind of complaining about. Yeah.
It's just really sad, but it's hard to take with everything that's going on, because it's like Matip, I think you said, Gareth, you know, he's made a ready solid crisp at the minute, and it's like, he's saying he can only play one game a week, but he's missed two now, hasn't he? And
he's unlikely for the weekend as well.
Okay, so if he's unlikely for the weekend, he's going to have to give that Reece Williams ago at centre-half. I think other than that, you're looking at Jordan Henderson dropping back and doing a job, I think. And I don't think we need that when we've got quite a few midfielders out. It's Atalanta away for me. Like, I think you need Matip fit for City no matter what now. I think even if Fabinho hadn't got an injury, I still think I would have been sat here saying we need Matip fit to go in the defence for City, because we need Fabinho in the midfield. But also, I think Matip against City is the best option defensively. I'm quite, like, I don't want to say worried, but curious to see what happens over the next two games. How is he going to manage it? I mean, I didn't know that Matip was unlikely to be out on Saturday. I would have thought he would have been back. So if he is,
I mean, we're saying this before Klopp's press conference, and obviously he'll update that, but
it's just hard, though.
The current reports are like, you know, it seems unlikely that
this is where your time management and sort of like your priorities come into real play, and this is where we'll see, you know, Jurgen Klopp be the proper manager that he is, as to how he prioritises games, the time. You know, we know he likes the five subs in the Champions League. You know, will he use that to his effect because of everything that's going on? These next few games will be quite fascinating, I think, to see how he manages his squad and what he sort of puts first, really, because do you drop, would you sort of take a hit in the league or take a hit in the Champions League and back yourself to win the other games? I'm really, really curious to see what he does.
I think what's worth saying, Mike, before we move on, is just that, you know, despite all these hits against us, really, if you like, so, you know, we've had players suffering with COVID, we've had injuries, we've had the goalie out, you know, we've had bad decisions going against us, we've had the Van Dijk situation, you know, as I said at the top, we're still winning though, and it's like, you know, we're in a good position in the league and things like that, and I just think, you know, that's testimony again, isn't it, to the spirit and the mentality that exists at the club.
Yeah, we don't win the league last year by accident, and we don't win it just because Van Dijk plays 60-yard balls to Mo Salah all the time, or like is great, or clearly the best centre-half in the world. It helps, massively helps, and it's a massive miss. Alisson was a miss last year, but we still won the league. I think Adrian played about 10, 11 games in the league, didn't he?
Yeah, 11, yeah.
So, like, the squad's there, and I think people just seem to forget it a little bit because of the panic of, oh shit, you know, Van Dijk is out for the season now, and how you know, who knows how he's going to return. We're light in midfield. You know, I think he changed to 4-2-3-1 because of the Thiago signing. You know, Thiago played really well for Bayern in a 4-2-3-1, lots. That really ran the show. You could say what you want about the German league, but he done it in the Champions League as well. They ended up winning that. I think when Thiago comes back in, it'll be either Thiago and Henderson or Thiago and Wijnaldum in the big games. And, you know, Fabinho at centre half. You know, ideally, as everyone's saying, you want Fabinho midfield, you want Van Dijk fit. If we haven't got Van Dijk this season, then sign. You want Matip and Gomez to be fit as possible for as long as possible. So, like, it's a battling season. I don't think I think I was talking to Lizzie the other day and I said 90 points. I'd shake hands right now on 90 points, because I don't think anyone gets above 90 points this season. I'd probably shake hands on 86 just because I don't think anyone's
mad, that, isn't it, when you look at the seasons before.
I just don't think anyone's getting above that. City have got 8 out of 5 games.
It's like an endurance test, isn't it, rather than you know,
them or us,
for everyone. I mean, you know, Lizzie said before about it, them coming thick and fast. I mean, I'm literally doing a final word show talking about one match and then walking into another room and starting to do a preview for the next one. It's like, this is wild. Anyway, enough of admin at the Anfield after. We have now got the other bits that I mentioned at the top. So we've got Paul Riley from Transition Liverpool with John Gibbons on a new project, Spark at Liverpool. Then you've got Neil Atkinson speaking to Dave O'Brien about a book on the culture industry in the UK that he's co-authored. So here you go.
And it is John Gibbons for The Weekender. I'm delighted to be joined over Zoom by Paul Riley, who's network leader from Transition Liverpool and is here to talk to us about a new project that the crowdfunding for called Spark at Liverpool. So, Paul, welcome to the Anfield Wrap.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
If you could tell us a little bit more about Spark at Liverpool then, about the inspiration behind it and what it is you're trying to do in Liverpool.
Yeah, so Spark at Liverpool is all about like sort of thinking about urban space, thinking about what we can do on our streets. It came from a global phenomenon called Parking Day, where people started to look at parking spaces as a way to quickly sort of do a pop-up in a city street, sort of getting people thinking about things like, what would we like our city streets to be about and how would we like to interact with our environment? In Transition, we're all about trying to support local economy and support like local communities to be stronger and to come together to support each other. And so before COVID came along, we were looking at doing Spark at Liverpool to just support local businesses and support the community organisations and charities. And then COVID happened and it became even more important like to think about what we do with our streets and what we do with our city space. So we're trying to support like local businesses, particularly hospitality and things like that, to get pop-ups outside their businesses and to sort of, you know, have that conversation around what we do with our streets.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because it feels like something that's perfect for now, but obviously has been created sort of before then. But I think in terms of, you know, encouraging people to come outside a little bit more and to kind of, you know, to obviously to buy and sell from each other, but also just communicate with each other is really important, because I know a lot of people sort of are kind of struggling really to how they fit in with society really, and don't necessarily feel safe sort of going into some places or whatever, and are working from home and stuff like this seems to me as much about just sort of getting people, you know, together in social environments as much as anything.
Yeah, I mean, I never thought in a million years that when Liverpool finally won the league, I'd be watching it from my couch with my wife. I knew I'd be watching it with my wife if it happens, but you know, I expect to be in a crowd of thousands of people, probably soaked in someone else's beer, and then go out and have a mad one. And it was just like, you know, the social isolation of these days, this day and age, is something that we never even imagined would happen 6 months ago. And so a community project to really sort of bring people together and give people the opportunity to safely interact with each other is so, so important. And, you know, what we really are interested in is things like climate change and environment, and trying to sort of talk about air pollution and talk about like getting more greenery in our local areas. So the first event that we're doing is our big sort of launch event is on Hope Street, and we're going to support 30 independent businesses and community organisations to create pop-up installations on the street on Hope Street. But beyond that, what we're looking at is also to go into the other areas of the city, go up into Croxteth, go into Tuebrook. I'm from LA, so we want to do one down here as well. We want to support all these areas to, like, you know, sort of get some more infrastructure out on the streets for themselves, because a lot of these areas, more deprived areas of the city, there's not a lot to do outside. We need these. We need to, like, COVID's not going away. I don't think we can kid ourselves anymore about, like, you know, when things go back to normal. There's not going to be a going back to normal. It's a new normal now. So we need to support, and it is an opportunity for us to try and build community. So after the first event, we're going to be going to different parts of the city and working with all of those individuals, with all those communities, to try and support the community groups to get focus, get places that people can be together and, like, sort of work together to build local economy and rebuild those relationships that we've lost.
How much support have you had within the city so far? Obviously, you know, you mentioned the the creative businesses who are looking to sort of get involved. But generally speaking, sort of across the city, how have people sort of engaged with you so far?
Well, overall it has been really, really positive. I know that the whole idea of parking spaces is quite a sort of controversial one for some people, because they think, well, if I can't park my car, what am I going to do? And we're not looking at like just banning cars from all of Liverpool. We're just looking at like changing small spaces for a short amount of time to give people the opportunity to think, well, what if we do it differently? What if we do things differently? What if some of the streets in the city, there's more cafe culture and there's more people who can be outside and there's more plants and greenery, and we get a healthier city and we get healthier kids and we get opportunities for businesses to operate safely, but at the same time, it can still all be accessible. So that's really one of the things that we're looking at. And we have had a really, really positive response from that. We've raised over £7,000 so far on the crowdfunder. And so we're not too far away from the total now.
Yeah, that crowdfunder, it's spacehive.com/SparkItLiverpool. I'll read that out again at the end. But as you say, it is getting pretty close at the moment. Two-thirds of the way there, a couple of weeks left. It'd be really nice, obviously, if Anfield Rap listeners could bump that over the edge.
It's a stressful thing, you know, doing a crowdfunder. It's just like doing a crowdfunder in a normal day and age is mad enough. But at the moment, like, you know, we're in a recession and everyone's skint and I'm still doing a crowdfunder. I feel like I've completely gone off the wall. But at the same time, you know, £7,000 there that proves me wrong, that says that people think this is a great idea. So, you know, if we get over the line there, we're gonna get so many amazing things happening in the city. And it's the starting point. Obviously, that's the crowdfunders for the events on Hope Street. We're going to have poetry, we're going to have art, we're going to have creativity, we're going to have all these amazing things happening and all these really great businesses out there selling their wares. But then we get to go to other places in the city. We're going to take it on tour across the city region. So this could be like a gateway drug to urban transformation. You know, it's such an exciting possibility and potential.
Yeah, no, anything that makes the city more vibrant and more exciting, and obviously, you know, we can get businesses, you know, out there in front of people, you know, we definitely support and we encourage everyone to have a look at it. I'll give that address to you again. It's spacehive.com/SparkItLiverpool. That's spacehive.com/SparkItLiverpool. If you can't find it, just give me a nudge and I'll point you in the right direction on social. But Paul, best of luck with it. If it all goes to plan, you get the money, do you know roughly when you're going to try and do the event? So people can obviously come down as well.
We're doing it whether we get the money or not. It's happening. We're already building things. We've already got loads of people who are on board, creating things like a pop-up speakers platform. We're going to do a recreation of a Van Gogh picture live in the streets. We're going to have theatre. We're going to have art. It's going ahead. Whether we get this crowdfunder or not, it just would be really helpful if we did. Obviously, we're looking for businesses to partner with us as well. So if any businesses out there who want to do a pop-up on Hope Street or want to support this, again, get in touch with us and then we'll see how we go from there. It's going ahead one way or another.
Yeah, we'll come and flog some tops. Nice one, mate. Really good, really nice to meet you, Paul, and best of luck with it all.
Thanks very much. Cheers, John.
And it is John Gibbons with another little insert. Now I'm delighted to be joined by Ian Jones from the Big Firework Company. But first of all, Ian, most importantly, a subscriber, Liverpool supported, of course, and one of our lot.
Absolutely mad red, mate. A pleasure to be here. And once again, thank you so much for the content you do. Could I, a little just adjustment, it's the Big Firework Shop.
I do apologise.
Based in Warrington, serving all your firework requirements for many years. So, yeah, cool.
So, obviously, at the moment, you know, people are sort of restricted to housing and things like that. We're used to the big displays and not able to do that. So, if people haven't done anything from home before and maybe a bit nervous about it, presumably can come and see you guys and you can talk them through it, how to do it sort of safely and how to get a pretty good display going in the back.
Yeah, I've been in the game for about 25 years, and everybody who comes into the shop, whatever they're purchasing, will always go over a very quick safety demonstration. We'll work with people. When people come in, we always say, these are the fireworks on this side for this, these are the fireworks on that side for this, these are garden fireworks, these are display fireworks. And we'll always help people, we'll always assist them and make sure that they're as safe as possible. With regard to displays being cancelled, it's a terrible shame. Halloween's basically cancelled. We don't know what's happening at Christmas. And Bonfire Night is the one night when we get to basically stick two fingers up at COVID. So let's do that.
Let's do that indeed. So you're based in Warrington and you're open all year round as well, aren't you? And you've been servicing people for a long time now.
Yeah, we're the biggest specialist retailer in the area that's open all year round, and we can open any time to suit you. Look on the website, bigfireworkshop.co.uk. All the details are on there. Call me. I can meet people anytime. But we're open every day now till, let me think, the 7th, 8th, 9th, till the 9th of November and then the weekend after. But if you need anything, just contact me. All my details are online.
And you're on social media, Facebook, Twitter and all that as well, if people want to check it out.
Instagram, the whole thing. Yep.
And most importantly, Ian, are Liverpool going to beat West Ham on Saturday?
I can't wait to see T. Diogo Jota back on. I expect amazing things from that guy. I really do. I think he's been a cracking signing. That'll be the quiz question in years to come. Who scored the 10,000th Liverpool goal? And we'll all remember and we'll all smile. I think it'll be a bit crushing. 4-0. Easy 4-0. Nice and simple.
Well, top man. Listen, Ian, it was nice to speak to you. It was nice to support you today. And obviously, thanks for subscribing. I know the subscribers like to support each other. So I'm sure if you pop in and see you in Warrington, you'll get well looked after.
We'll always sort out fellow Reds, John.
It's up, man.
It's Neil Atkinson, and I am joined by Dave O'Brien, who is one of the three authors of a book, which is somewhat provocatively called Culture is Bad for You. The book is about the way in which culture operates, both in terms of its production and its consumption in the present day. And it very much emphasizes the extent to which culture, I'll let Dave talk about it in a minute, but is in lots of different ways, but certainly where the industry is concerned, a bit of a closed off segment and is difficult for social mobility and so on. You might wonder why we're doing this. Well, I was one of the people who Dave interviewed within this, but also I just simply find it very, very interesting indeed. I'd like to think that you will as well. So Dave, ultimately, this is an intersectional look between class, race, gender, sexuality, at the way in which culture works in this country. And a part of that is football, and a part of that is what the Anfield Rap does, a part of that is what a lot of different football writing is. But ultimately, it's a look at the entirety of the creative industry and how it is nowhere near as egalitarian as perhaps at times it likes to tell itself.
Yeah, totally. And like, thanks for having me on to talk about it. It's slightly weird in a way to be talking about it now, because obviously the title Culture is Bad for You, we thought of as a way of like sounding a bit of an alarm. But now, you know, all of these kind of cultural organizations that have like live audiences are shuttered. People are worried about, you know, their jobs, their businesses, their income, stuff like that. So, you know, it's slightly weird to be kind of saying culture is bad for you in this context. But one thing the pandemic moment has kind of thrown up has been the way that some people are, I guess, like slightly more able or slightly better place to survive these kind of catastrophic conditions. And that's exactly what the book is about, really. This sense of, you know, some people have got like lots of resources, whether that's like networks, whether that's cultural connections, whether it's as blunt and simple as having loads of money, or, you know, owning their own house or having family support or whatever. And then other people are struggling much more. And we look at the way that kind of corresponds to individuals' class origin, their race, their gender, and particularly how those three things kind of come together as well. And we've got like particular looks, particular like deep dives about socially mobile Black British women, you know, who particularly struggle in like the music industry, the visual arts industry, in media and television, stuff like that.
There's, within all of this, there is that sort of what we often tell ourselves, myself included, really, is that there's a conflict between high culture and low culture, and that how that's perceived. There's a conflict between sort of elite culture and the culture that sort of bubbles along in our towns and cities, and that, well, these things are different. And one of the things the book goes out of its way to demonstrate is that actually that isn't the case, that how each of those areas acts and interacts with people from different backgrounds, from ultimately less white middle class male backgrounds, it almost transposes from each of these industries. It isn't as though each of these facets, each of these aspects, it's always the same right the way through. It isn't as though, for instance, pop culture's getting it right, but it's the opera that's getting it wrong. That's a lazy assumption that we sometimes feel as though we can make, and that just isn't the case here.
No, totally. And I mean, it's important to stress, like, you know, working in telly is a different industry as compared to working in the music industry.
Yeah.
Being part of, like, you know, being a curator in the visual arts world or whatever. But actually you see, you know, these similar kinds of, we call them like structures, but, you know, these similar sort of patterns in these workforces. And actually, you know, you're spot on. It's not like we can point to the commercial music industry and say, well, actually, you know, that's all sound. And then in classical, it's like full of, you know, snobbish posh people or whatever. Actually, there are loads of issues in the classical music industry about, you know, kind of snobbishness. But in many ways, it's like, you know, slightly more egalitarian than the commercial music industry is for women, for example. So, yeah, like there's something to do with how, I guess, we kind of produce culture and the kind of, you know, the cultural hierarchies that we give value to and the people we give value to within those hierarchies that we were trying to drill down into.
To do this book, you obviously have an awful lot of academic research in terms of looking at the work that other people have done, building on it and working from there. But you also go out and you do, between the three of you, the authors, you do over 225 interviews. I think it's 237, but you might tell me it's more. And speak to people right the way across the country. And I think that that's important as well. One of the things that you do refer to within the book is that there is, a regional aspect to part of this. But even within that, again, the idea that, for instance, I'll just use Liverpool and London, that there's more egalitarianism within Liverpool than London doesn't necessarily stand up either. That we might want to think that that's the case. We might want to tell ourselves that, but actually that doesn't stand up. And your interviews that you've done all over the country, not just sticking into particular sort of geographic sectors, tells you that story as well.
Yeah, I mean, we were really lucky, actually. We had help from a couple of other academics who were doing interviews with us, and we were in the field, as we like to call it, ourselves. And it's so interesting, that the comparisons, because in some ways, you know, you can talk, and I hate these terms, but you can talk about like the regions, places that have got their own kind of cultural and creative economies, and people can do, you know, well, they can have, you know, sustainable careers and sustainable lives in these places. And it's not just Liverpool, but, you know, Manchester, Birmingham, Newcastle, and we've got, you know, kind of rural settings as well for particular kinds of occupations. And then everyone is like, but yeah, if you're not in London, like, you'll never make it, you're totally excluded. But then at the same time, we can see that even within London, there are these like weird dynamics where a lot of London's cultural system is totally unrepresentative of London's own population.
Yeah.
And particularly actually when you get into the bigger institutions, whether you're thinking about, you know, the big telly companies, or whether you're thinking about, classical music orchestras, or, you know, national level galleries and museums, there's a big difference between their workforce and then the overall population of London. So even where you've got, examples of places that we think are doing well, there are still these kind of dynamics of exclusion. And even where you've got places where you're like, oh, you know, maybe that's kind of bad for the rest of the country, actually it's bad in its own terms as well.
You do a chapter specifically which focuses in on gender and on how women effectively, to an extent, opt out. They're opted out. The opportunities aren't there, but they also feel as though, because so much of the creative industries, and we see this with the Anfield Rap all the time, because so much of the creative industries, it happens at certain times, it's not necessarily 9-to-5 sort of working environments, that because women's are often left to be in the role of carer, and we'll just leave it a carer for now, as you do to an extent within the book, are often left and have that expectation upon them, and that expectation internalized that they will be carers first and foremost. There ends up being an opting out of certain things. And I say it all the time in things that pertain to football, with reference to women, and things that pertain to culture in this city with reference to women as well, that they're always the ones who feel either have that imposed upon them, or, and the answer is probably both, also feel as though, well, they have to go and fulfill a completely different life role, and that opts them out of the creative industries, of the creative process.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, like, you know, two white fellas talking about women's struggles.
We always sound ridiculous, don't worry, Dave. We always sound ridiculous. I mean, it could be worse, Dave. We could be talking about football, acting like we know things.
True, very, very, very true. We were dead struck by the data, because this, like, we didn't actually ask specific questions about things like, caregiving or like, you know, expectations about family, stuff like this. That came up almost kind of like organically talking to women working in these creative occupations. And we were just really, really struck by the way that on the one hand, maybe on like the surface, there would be stories of like, well, you know, I had two kids, I wanted to spend time with them. So, you know, I kind of, you know, went part-time or whatever. I sort of adapted my life to these responsibilities. But under the surface, there was also this kind of story of like, and we use theatre as our big case study in that chapter, of women saying, well, actually, I was told, well, if you can't do an 80-hour week, you shouldn't be here. Mm. And it sort of struck us like, well, what is it about, you know, this industry, but also it's exactly the same in media. You see similar things, but slightly distinctive in museums. It's totally the same in music. What is it about these industries where individuals are really kind of comfortable saying, well, you know, if you can't do these like crazy, often unpaid hours or whatever, then the job isn't for you and that's your problem, not ours. And how do you like, you know, rationally adapt to that? Because it's really difficult to like resist that. You've got to have unbelievably like good connections, high levels of basically wealth to sustain yourself. And you've also got to have this like crazy sense of confidence to say, actually, I'm going to take a bunch of risks to say no in the context of people who might be like, you're a troublemaker if you're asking for working or whatever, we're never going to work with you again. And there was, as you say, this kind of dynamic of, you know, totally almost kind of rational and reasonable decisions to opt out, but also under the surface, things that we basically really need to be kind of changing, need to make people aware of, in some ways like need to be kind of legislating and regulating better as well.
Just to sort of pull us back around to football in a sense, because you mentioned their legislation and regulation, a lot of the attitudes I think within the book are sort of that they, and I think it's important, I think one of the things you are almost trying to do is trying to say, listen, don't think the creative industries aren't like other industries. Don't think there's something special about the creative industries because everybody gets to create. They end up working like other industries. And a lot of these attitudes and issues are just simply structural within British society. I was struck by Rick Parry's letter to the EFL, wherein he cites grounds in Rochdale, Grimsby, Mansfield and Carlisle might seem an awful long way from Glyndebourne or the Royal Ballet. He's clearly playing a specific card there, Rick, but you know, important part of our nation's heritage. It's deeply unfair that cultural institutions like these are receiving handouts and also able to generate revenues, etc., etc. One of the things about that is that there's just been, with reference to who has or hasn't got the handouts from governments in an art sphere, in a cultural sphere, and within that as well, you got to see, I think, to an extent, exactly who was sort of perceived to be in a gang as such. And that doesn't just happen across that, you know, that's not to me to say that that's everybody who managed to receive those public subsidies. But there is, within that, this stuff, it is the same as with other industries. And it is something that is set by our national character, by our national structures. It is within every part of this country. And every now and again, whether it's on the football or whether it's on those subsidies in this time of crisis, we get to see that reaffirmed for us.
Yeah. And I mean, one of the things that's really crucial as well is not pitching these things against each other as well. And I think that's, you know, it's politically quite effective to almost kind of, you know, shame politicians to say, well, you know, you said you're going to do this and now you're doing this. And look, you know, we can sort of like build a political agenda of these towns against the Royal Opera House or whatever. But actually, you know, what's going on there, as you say, is a sense of here's what we value and here's what we don't. And the kind of the route through this is to think again about how we have a much broader sense of what we value and why it is precisely that we don't give, you know, town-based lower league football teams the same status, because they're incredibly important community assets as these institutions that we quite openly talk about as, you know, crown jewels or whatever the minister's preferred term is, that have these, you know, national asset, national community asset statuses. And that, I guess, conversation is, it's a big job to build a politics around that, you know, a kind of solidarity across these different cultural spheres. I mean, the other thing is resources as well. And you can see this in Footy so clearly. Some organizations are well set up to take advantage of how, you know, funding systems work. They've got extra people working with them. They can, you know, negotiate maybe directly with ministers and with treasury. They know how to fill forms in, you know, that kind of stuff. Whereas others are just, you know, it's a couple of people struggling to advance a particular kind of creative agenda or to keep a football institution going. And actually, in some ways, and you know, the Anfield Rap talks quite a lot about this, that goes right the way up as well. And we, you know, perceive these sometimes Premier League clubs as being much kind of better resourced and having much more capacity than they actually do. And again, thinking about this as, well, how can we build capacity so we've got much more of a kind of like level playing field across institutions is something that's really, really important. And not to be too political, but that's one of the things that there really seems to be an absence of kind of government thinking around that particular question.
We can't be too political, and the book is indeed really quite political, and it's excellent. I'll read you a quote. Culture is Bad for You is a sobering, enraging picture of the creative industries and the inequalities at the heart. Using data, case studies, and sharp analysis, the result holds to account a culture that isn't just a reflection of a rigged society, but an engine of it. For anyone who works in British culture or cares who does, or simply values true equality of opportunity, this is essential reading. That's from Danny Lee, who writes for the Financial Times and the BBC. It is available on Manchester University Press. It's Orion Brooke, Dave O'Brien and Mark Taylor. Do check it out. Genuinely, it is very readable. It is an academic text, but it is very, very readable indeed. It's Culture is Bad for You. Thank you very much to Dave, and let's get back on. It's Neil Atkinson and John Gibbons. It's Beer 52-5-2. We're going to say more and more of that in a minute or two. But they are back with us, John. And you can get the exclusive case worth £24 for nothing but the postage, £5.95 if people sign up. Beer52.com/wrap. And they have been on the case to find the best beer they can anywhere in the world.
Yeah, good on them. It's a tough ask, but someone's got to do it. I bet it's graft.
It's honestly, yeah.
Like when Stevie goes to New York to look at bars.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, you know, it's the toughest game in the world. The hunting down beer game.
Two trips a year to look at New York bars.
Yeah. I'd honestly, I'd be doing the same thing at Beer 52, scouring the globe, these fellas. Night and day, they're at it to try to get results for you, for the consumer to enjoy the very best that you can. I like the idea they've got like piles of cans that they're constantly ranking, empty cans that they're ranking in different orders. It's like a visual thing. It goes from one end of the room to the other to see whether or not they've found. Have we found the best 8 to send out this week? Yes or no? And then finally they do it, John, then they commit.
I loved it as well. They've got here, what they found this month is from an ancient German brewery, which is an Edel Lager. This session IPA from a garden brewery in Croatia, and then West Yorkshire's own vocation. And I was like, is that Huddersfield? And they're just trying to make it sound more glamorous.
It could be Huddersfield. It could indeed be Huddersfield right the way through. It must be a nightmare for those other beers having to sit in the same box as the West Yorkshire one, telling them that Yorkshire's better.
Yeah, how do you know a beer is from West Yorkshire? It's already told you,
yeah. Absolutely. Sorted that one out for you. So, yeah, if you don't like the dark beer, you can choose the light option. And each case comes with the award-winning magazine Ferment, which was a big highlight of my lockdown, and a tasty snack to enjoy along with your beer. There is no minimum commitment. So you just take the free case. You can try it all, and then you can decide it's not for you, and you can just cancel there and then. So it is 8 for £3. At this time of year, in the run-up for Christmas, it might be worth considering. It's Beer 5252, beer52.com/wrap to claim your free case, and it will be available to you right now. And it is the business, genuinely, in all seriousness, I am a customer of Beer 52, so I have put my money where my mouth is, which works, I think, in three different ways in the context of this advert. So I am all over it. It is beer52.com/wrap. They are delightful. At some point soon, in fact, maybe over the weekend, maybe when we're on the hot mic or something, next, you and I, John, I might actually bring the case in and we can go through them together, and that'd be quite nice as well. And maybe we can remember that and maybe write some stuff down so that we can remember it and then mention it the next time we're doing this. So yeah, beer52.com/wrap. It's a really good time to come and get involved. I'm having a ball with it. Take it easy.
Okay, nice one to Paul, John, Neil and Dave there. So West Ham then, a potential Halloween hammer horror and all that kind of gear. Siobhan, Anfield's not traditionally a happy hunting ground for them. They've always been a bit of a side that you know, you expect to win against, I would say. And, you know, they've won just one of their last 47 away at Liverpool. They won 3-0 in 2015, which was sort of one of the games that led to the ta-ra to Brendan. And in general, we've only ever lost four to them at home in our history, which is, you know, quite damning of them as well. They are, however, it's worth saying, in decent nick at the moment. The odds, though, are still quite massive, as they always are, as I always mention. You can get 15-2 on West Ham for this game to win. But as I say, you go back through recent results. We did the double over them last season. We won 3-2 at Anfield. We won 2-0 away. Season before, we drew there and we won 4-0 at Anfield. And there's been quite a few fours. So we've got a 4-0 at Anfield 2018, 4-1 at Anfield 2018. We beat them 4-1 away. We beat, yeah, so there's loads of fours and there's loads of us beating them. But as I say, they've done some decent stuff in recent times, their recent results. They drew with Man City. They had a 3-3 draw with Tottenham Hotspur. They beat Leicester City 3-0 away, which was an impressive result. They lost 4-1 to Everton, though. Just saying. And they beat Wolves 4-0, though, which is also impressive.
But then they got beat by Newcastle, so like it's just opens up.
The weird.
Yeah.
I know, obviously, loads of. I think every Liverpool fan out there is currently sweating over whether Antonio's going to be.
Oh, apparently, he's fit.
Fit or not. He is fit.
The show, apparently, so. Apparently, he's all right.
I read that Moyes is going to update on Friday, and it kind of feels like they might be blagging it. And I really hope they are, because, you know, it'd be massive. He scored 5 against us. He always, you know, he's one of them.
Yeah. Even those, you know, you talk about all those wins and stuff. I don't, the 4-0s aside, even last season, that was, the one at Anfield was tough, wasn't it? It was, didn't they go 2-1 up and then we went 3-2? It was one of those games where you kind of hoped it was never in doubt, but that was just the trajectory we were on. But the game, you were like, okay, we're not in doubt, but do something like now, basically, because this is looking like it's falling away from us. I've got a slight nervous feeling in the pit of my stomach about this game. Don't West Ham play like 5 at the back? Don't they? Yeah. They're like,
well, they'll
make this a dog
like
of a game.
Three at the back, haven't they? I think because Aaron Cresswell was talking about being moved to a three. But I think they might change and, like, you know, with the possession. Yeah. I think when we're in possession, they might move back to a back five.
I mean, that's going to make this a really horrendous hour and a half of viewing, isn't it? I'm not looking forward to it whatsoever, because I think what the Tottenham game is, and you've got to take the opposition into account, that Tottenham do have a habit of, I don't want to use the phrase, but spursing it, you know, I hate that phrase. But it just goes to show that you cannot get complacent and you cannot relax. And I think what Liverpool have been in the last few games is a little bit complacent. I think was it yesterday, the day before? I don't know. It was literally Tuesday. Was it 5 minutes ago? I don't know. Tuesday, you know, the 2-0 probably flatters in that it makes it sound like an easy kind of routine game, and it absolutely was not. West Ham were probably fortunate not to lose it towards the end against City, but they made it really hard work for City, and I think they're going to do the same against us. Yeah, I think if Mikel Antonio plays, I think what's the other lad, Benrahma, is it? He's going to play in his place if he isn't fit, and he looked.
Or Gamalenko, maybe.
Yeah, he looked.
He's a mad cat.
We were linked with him ages ago, weren't we?
Yeah, he scores loads for his country.
And don't forget Big Andy Carroll. Do you know what I mean?
Andy can't play for them.
Newcastle, edit.
Last time. You can't have Atalanta and Carl in 1 week, can you? Anyway, he's too busy having a million kids.
Oh, hey.
Well, Lizzie then, Antonio, did go off with a hamstring injury against City. 3 goals this season, 11 goals since footy returned after lockdown. He's absolutely loving playing in front of no crowds. And obviously scored an overhead against City as well. 5 goals, like I mentioned, against Liverpool. We could really do with him not playing, as much as you never want to wish that on any player. I'm quite heavily wishing it on him, I've got to be honest. Moyes to update in press conference. There's various reports, like Siobhan said. Some say he will, some say he won't. But then, you know, like I say, you're suddenly dropping down quite a lot. Like, Yarmolenko should be dead good and is capable of being. But have you seen him when he came on the other day? Yeah. It looked like he'd never played footy.
How many did he give away on that wing? It was mad. So it was wild.
It's one of them. I think that would be in in Liverpool's favour. Another thing I think that is in Liverpool's favour that we should mention is that the manager is David Moyes, and he just seems to shit his bills at the sight of Liverpool Football Club. I mean, it's like, you know, he's never won away to Liverpool as a manager. And, you know, there's got to be a reason for that. You know, he's another odd cat.
He's another mad cat. Listen, you never know, though. The no crowd thing, it might very much mean that he's not doing anything in his bills, and he's having a nice time. Well, I'm just, Gareth used the term, not me. I'm just talking about Andy Carroll when he was at West Ham, not Newcastle. So I think Antonio's always been a threat for Liverpool. Like, when he plays games, he seems to be that type of player who, he'll be one of those where you'll go, remember when he always used to score against Liverpool? He's the Luis Suarez against Norwich for West Ham. That's what he is. And I think he's definitely a threat, but I think we've definitely got more than them. I just think, like I say, it's what happens with that back four, isn't it, and how they perform. Like, the onus is probably going to be a lot on them. Hopefully, fingers crossed, Thiago comes back in the midfield or whatever, but there's going to be a lot of work to do there. And I think they're not soft. Like, they know how Antonio plays. They know the form that he's in at the moment. They know he loves scoring against us, and they will be picking apart now. They'll be looking at that Michelin game with Reece Williams coming on and having a look. Where can we target? Where can we get in? I don't know, everyone does that, but we are a lot more vulnerable than we have been all season, and we are playing an informed team. They are informed. They're playing well. They're doing well. I'm a little bit like Siobhan. I am a bit nervous about it, and it's not because I don't back Liverpool. It's just because I think the season has been so mad that it feels like anyone can take points off anyone at the moment. And, like, I know you're saying about David Moyes and stuff, and any other day I'd be like, yeah, that's a thing. But I feel like with the no fans thing, God knows what could happen. But hopefully, I mean, I think we'll have enough. I do think that will be a factor, though, as to whether he plays or not, as to what the result will be.
I mean, we've got to say as well, Mike got absolutely brilliant at home, and, you know, fans or no fans, it's 62 games now in the Premier League without defeat, which is absolutely amazing. And I think they're on the verge of another sort of another record. In fact, I might have it here dead quick if I can find it. Hang on. they're unbeaten in 62. Won 28 of the last 29 at Anfield, and if they avoid defeat here, it equals the Reds' longest ever unbeaten home run in their league history.
If David Moyes ends that, oh my God.
Do you know what I mean? So he can fuck
David
off.
Fucking Moyes.
But you can't have Moyes getting involved, you know, upsetting that. And what else? Yeah. What do you think on this one, Mike? Everyone's saying there, aren't they, it's going to depend on what type of side we put out. I think, as I said near the start, things don't look hugely positive for our matter. We know Fabinho's not going to play. There's talk today in certain reports that it could actually be Nat Phillips rather than Reece Williams, because he's 23, Reece is 19. You know, I don't think personally Phillips has particularly impressed anyone, but, you know, he was at Stuttgart on loan and played 22 games there. So there's an argument to say he's more experienced and he's played at a higher level. But equally, you had Klopp saying Reece did really well. But then he also said, we now have the problem that there's 4 days until West Ham and you're going to write a story about him every day. And that's pretty much proven to be the case so far. Everyone's gone and interviewed everyone who's ever played for Kidderminster Harriers. So the sort of, you know, a thing is built around him which might add pressure on him. He is a kid, he is a teenager, he is liable to making a mistake, and you don't want a mistake to destroy him, do you?
No, he's not. To be fair, though, the character he seems to be, as in going to Kidderminster, when he could have easily just sat at Liverpool, got trained with, you know, in and around Melwood and that, and got the odd game maybe in the FA Cup. You know, he chose to go out and that, so maybe I think he'd just block all that out as best as, but as much as you can block things up like that. You know, you're a 19-year-old lad, and your name's in the news every single day. You've just made what was a really good performance, not really putting a foot wrong at all. All right, you can say it was wasn't Barca, was it? But it, you know, for him, it's his biggest game of his career. Basically, getting the best part of 70 minutes, you'd say maybe.
Yeah.
Against at Anfield, you know, clean sheet, played well. So yeah, I can see the Nat Phillips thing now, because he come back and played the FA Cup game against Everton in that mad team. And, you know, he didn't disgrace himself. Did he play with Vandenberg that day, didn't he? Or was it Gomez? Actually, it was Gomez.
Is like why he wasn't involved in the Champions League? Is it something he's not in the squad, is he? Declaring him? Because obviously he was on the bench in the league, but wasn't for the Champions League.
Yeah, I'm not possibly. Sure. He's not in, might not be in the squad.
I just think, you know, for them anyway, like it massively depends on Antonio. If he's fit to do 90, which I don't think he will be, what do you want to do then? Do you want to just keep it tight and give him half an hour? Like 0-0, 1-0, Moyes defo bite your hands off for 1-0 on 65 to lash Antonio on now if he could. Mm. And he'd bang that Suchek up and around because he's a big fella, isn't he?
Yeah.
So, you know, that's one way of going at it for them. If Antonio can't do the 90, but if he can, and it's just a bit of, you know, paper talks and a blaggers, I don't think Jürgen's bothered, to be honest. I think if we, as Lizzie said, if Thiago's back, you know, we've seen Chelsea, 45 minutes of Chelsea he got, didn't he, and the game against Everton where he's just disguising all sorts of passes left, right and centre, having everyone's kecks off, like, oh, you think I'm going out to the left wing, bang, I'll just put Mo in. It's just like I don't see it, but I think he might come and do 5-4-1 when out of possession and try and block it up, but you know, I'm not that bothered because we've had that for about 20 of them 28 games. I don't reckon many teams come to Anfield and properly have a go anymore. So I think, you know, we used to really say, oh, they parked the bus, it was tough and this, that and the other. All them things have just gone now and we just keep going. Like, there's no excuses with this Liverpool team. It's self-police really well. It feels like they can make a mistake and not need to be told by Klopp or the analysts and that, but, you know, they will be and what have you. And Klopp was going absolutely off his head on Tuesday. Like, he was fuming with the... Well, I don't know what you call it. It was just a lack of, like, urgency, maybe, or something like that. But, again, it's just knowing we're good enough to be able to do that. And it's like, West Ham will push us to where we need to be. We can either just... If Thiago plays, I think it just doesn't matter. Thiago plays with Mo and Sadio and Bobby, yeah, who's starting to come back into a bit of form. I just think that all the best to West Ham. Like, do what you want, and you can have your plans with Antonio and Suchek and whatever, like, but all the best trying to keep that front three out, even in the form we're in.
It's also, like, important to remember, and this is to myself as well, so, you know, we're talking about the fact that they're in form and the fact that they come back to score three goals, but they still shipped three goals to Tottenham. And I know Harry Kane and Son are in form at the moment, but, like, our front three are better than them, so you know if they are conceding, so and that's the thing. Like, I think we just need to back ourselves, and especially if Thiago's in, like, I feel like anyone can put any formation. They could put like 10 double deckers there, and he'd still find a way to get a ball through to the front three. So
be honest, that Tottenham game now, that Lanzini strike, he's never doing that again. Like, it was an absolute worldie to make it 3-0 last minute sort of thing, and Tottenham are crap when someone puts them under pressure. So I know West Ham are in form, is that new there, but I just feel like it's that season where I expect Everton are on 13 points at the moment, should be on 12, but that's another conversation. We should be on 15. But I reckon Everton will be not over 20 points before Christmas, because they've had such a good start, and then now they've got like a few good teams coming up. So you'll see West Ham start to drop points, and like I said before, City are on 8 points. It's mad, in 5 games, 8 points. That's poor. And United, you know, are down there, Chelsea, Arsenal. The normal, like, people you'd expect up and around the top of the table aren't, and we're the only ones who are, and we're perceived to be going through this mad thing where all Liverpool are going to get beat again, and we just didn't.
And City are still favourites to win the league, which, for reasons I'm not quite sure about, but there you go. I mean, yeah, Siobhan, Billy Cometio's out as well. Klopp mentioned him the other day, obviously likes him as well, he's another option, but he's not an option right now. Obviously, that's led to some, you know, discussion around some of the more wild card options. A lot of people talking about Genie because he played that against Brighton in the three and they won 5-1. And then Henderson obviously played in the World Cup semi-final win over Monterrey with Gomez. Mad that Gomez and Matip have never started a game together, by the way. But
is that still the case?
Yeah.
I don't reckon they've ever played together in China, I reckon.
They never met.
I mean, what are you thinking it's going to be? Do you think we might see Nat Phillips?
My main reason for not, I trust whatever gets done in the end, but the reason I don't want to see Wijnaldum or Henderson there, albeit they are those kinds of, I think they've got that reputation as being proper utility players, and they'll do whatever's asked of them wherever they want, and they'll be all right because they're just, that's the standard they hold themselves to. But you're taking them out of where they're really effective and where they're going to need to really be effective. Exactly. Like, it's like, yeah, just stick them in, and then there's just Keita looking around going, well, what?
Because we've got no Fabinho and Thiago might not
make
it.
What's the story with Thiago? Like,
I mean, again, it's the reports today are sort of saying still not available, but you know,
we thought Alisson wasn't available. I know, this week, didn't we?
You have to wait for Klopp's update, really, on it. Keita as well as another one not expected to play. Oxlade-Chamberlain still out. Milner played 90 midweek.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like the idea that you're dropping a midfielder into the defence, another one. Mm. Well, who's playing in midfield?
Yeah. I think there's probably a little bit of between Klopp and Moyes, although I don't think he's the type to play games, Klopp. I think there's probably a little bit of who's going to move first on who's showing the hands in terms of who's available and who's not available. I think that if Mikel Antonio is not available, then it takes the pressure off whoever is there. And I think Nat Phillips has never, it's just like you were saying before, like he's never disgraced himself per se, and he plays against Everton with you know, with that mad lineup. But do you really want him to come in what's already going to be tricky against a form team in a depleted side where all it takes is a little knock to his confidence? The thing is that the mental strain, the emotional strain will be far lesser on a Wijnaldum or a Henderson if they were to do something wrong that led to something happening. So I don't necessarily think it's the time to take that risk. But then again, I don't think it's the time to take really good midfielders out of where they should be and where they're going to be most effective. So, I don't know. Is the answer
is Hans going to be forced? I think that's what your well, that's what I saw.
I think it's Reece or not. You know, I don't think we're doing the wild card thing.
It has to be, because you're not having a midfield like you just said there about Milner getting 90. Like, he won't start, and if he does, you're looking at him getting 60 tops. Like, that's just the way it is with Milner. You're looking at Curtis Jones. Like, I thought Keita would be back because I thought it was like a coronavirus quarantine thing, and I can't remember where the days have gone, if he was, you know, if he was out of it or whatever. But like, I think his hand will be forced, and I think he's going to have to play one of Nat Phillips or Reece Williams. It's just whichever one. I think it'd be really harsh to take it away from Reece Williams.
I do, and I think that Reece Williams, as much as he did, he was good on Tuesday, he had very little to do, didn't he? Like, and you know, you can't account for that, can you? You can't account for like your senior, albeit senior defensive midfielder in defence, coming off and him having to be thrown in. He gives me this impression of he's just not arsed at what gets thrown at him, Reece Williams. I think he's got just such an air of calm for such a young lad, and no one, like, if he can get as much stick for capitalising all the words in his tweets and still capitalise all the words in his tweets, he's just not bothered what anyone's saying. So I do think it would be unfair to for him to not get that, albeit I think the challenge will be much bigger this time around.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, some of the stuff that has come out this week about him. Apparently he did make quite a few mistakes when he first started playing for Kidderminster, but wasn't asked. Do you know what I mean? Like, took the criticism on board, and then, you know, was happy to improve, and by the end, you know, it seems now that most everyone who managed him and played with him is all speaking really positively about him. I mean, they're saying they're surprised to see him playing in the Champions League, don't get me wrong, but they're also saying, I wouldn't have been surprised if he'd ended up in the Championship. He's good enough to be there at this time. So yeah, we shall see. I mean, Lizzie, what are you thinking then, score wise because you didn't seem very sure then.
I'm gonna back Liverpool to win. I'm because of the defensive question mark, I was gonna say frailties, but I'm gonna call it a question mark. I'm gonna say about a 2-1 or a 3-1 to Liverpool.
Okay, Mike.
I can see us going back to a 3 in the middle to try and compensate for the defence, an extra body, and I can see it working. I don't know, it's just something about Sadio and Mo at the minute where it's just about to click. Mm. Like that ridiculous goal, the offside one. So I'm going to say 3-0.
I like it.
I'm saying 2-0. I think the pattern of the game will probably be quite similar to Tuesday's, in that we're going, what the fuck, for 75 of it, and oh, all right, for two small bursts of decency. I think that's what it's going to be like.
Any win will do, Reds. Just win. Just fucking win. Just win. That has been the weekend. Let's see what happens. As ever, there will be loads of stuff before and afterwards from the Anfield app, video, podcast, stuff on the website as well, and stuff on the socials too. So look out for all of that. Nice one to everyone who just took part in the show today. Up the fucking Reds. Sports Social Podcast Network.